Thanks very much, Werner. I'm going to start by showing you a couple of short videos just to get you into this. And the first one of these is an interview. I was told that it may possibly have been shown in this room before, and you may or may not have seen it. But hands up if you have seen the thing. I'm a few of you. Okay, so there's enough who haven't. But this is an American Christian group, and it's doing some interviews, and it really speaks for itself, I think.
In light of all the conversation about gender and identity, we began to wonder if there's even a difference between men and women anymore. We went to Seattle University to find out.
I'm aware of the conversation going on in Washington State right now around kind of gender identity, gender expression issues, and the ability to access facilities on those grounds.
There's gender neutral bathrooms and like all the dorms and stuff like that.
I think that gender is fluid, so if you want to use a bathroom because that's a place and that's a space where you feel comfortable and safe in doing so, then I think that that's completely fine.
I think that if whoever you think you are, if you're male or female, then that's the bathroom you should go into.
I think if it doesn't really negatively affect anybody, then I think anyone should be able to choose what gender they choose to identify as.
People, no matter what their gender identification is, they should be allowed to use whatever restrooms they should, if they feel like they identify with.
Is there a difference in your mind between men and women?
Possibly. In general, yes. But I don't know why I think that.
Socially, currently, yes, there is. There is no need for that difference to exist, scientifically and logically.
If you think that you're a male, if you think that you're a female, that matters more than the biological difference.
There's not much difference besides what society forces on people.
And how do you know the difference between men and women?
By what people think they are. So you can't, like, judge someone just on, like, their looks.
I don't think there's any one way to really distinguish between a man or a woman, and I don't think it's necessary.
It's not always consistent. It has a high probability, like 90% of the time I can get it right. There is some ambiguity.
I think, yeah, there are ways to tell, but then again, you can always be wrong.
What would you say I am?
Just judging off of your looks, I would say that you're a male. I would probably assume a man, but then you never know. A male.
Why would you say that?
Based on how I look at you.
Do you think that's a problem?
Yeah, probably.
Do you think the difference between men and women matters for any reason?
No, not really.
I think most sociologists agree that the concept of gender is more of a societal construct.
I do think it matters somewhat, yeah.
To me, no. I don't feel as if it matters to me because at the end of the day, the person is just a person.
No, I don't think it should matter.
And the differences on a social level are simply a product of a biased society.
Then is there a reason to have those labels, male and female?
I don't think so. I think that it's, again, a social construct of this binary that we're given at birth.
There is kind of a difference, but at the same time, if someone wants to identify as one or both or as nothing, I also find that completely okay.
There may be nothing more self-evident in the natural universe than the fact that every animal species is divided into two halves, male and female. Yet the most intelligent of those species seems to be wrestling with whether male or female are actually real things. Have we discovered something new, or have we become too clever for our own good?
Sometimes when I call a lady sir by accident, they get very offended.
Okay. It's funny, isn't it? Why is it funny?
I think we think they're Americans, aren't we? Never happened here.
Yes. But it is happening here. Yeah. It's happening here. And notice the language there. No, it's the gender I was assigned at birth. It's gender is just a social construct. It's the product of biased conditioning.
Yeah.
I don't think it should matter. It's what you think you are. It's what you identify with that what you are. So there's a shift from biology to thinking, or from groin to brain, if you like. Now, why is it that so many young people are thinking like this? Well, let me just show you a bit of another video. And this is the kind of thing, we may think that we're living in the same world as the younger millennial generation, if you like, but actually we're living in a very different world because of social media and because of the things that they're watching that are leading them to think differently. So let me just show you this video, which is a very good example of what people are watching.
I couldn't imagine not having him in my life in some way, friendship, relationship, my butler or something, I don't know.
They've been the champions of the transgender community. Katie Hill and Aaron Andrews both changed gender at the same time, leading to romance between the young couple. Their fight to change views on gender gave them a unique bond, but the two recently split, to the dismay of their family and friends. While Katie has fully transitioned and is embracing her new life, Aaron feels left behind and now wants to complete his transition more than ever with dangerous surgery.
Doing things like this with the girls, you know, getting my nails done, getting my hair done, helps me take my mind off the breakup.
2 years ago, Katie, who was born Luke, had full gender reassignment, costing $40,000.
I'm pretty much just like one of the girls, you know. The people who don't know, yeah, they join a sorority, come sleep over, come be my roommate next year in my apartment, and none of them any the wiser. And that's awesome.
Yeah.
But while Katie is being one of the girls, Aaron still feels he has more to do on his journey to become a man.
It's been a few months past my top surgery, and having it done was the best decision I could have made besides starting testosterone. Because now I'm way more comfortable with my body. Now I can just throw my shirt off with the guys and go jump in the pool, go work out.
But full gender reassignment for females to males is risky. And Aaron's mum, Denise, is worried that the breakup with Katie is pushing Aaron towards a rash decision.
As soon as they broke up, that was one of the first things he started hounding me about. I was concerned about that, spiraling down into depression. And those are the kind of things that we haven't had to deal with for a while since he's transitioned.
Knowing the risks, Katie was worried too.
I do feel really bad about Aaron's surgery. It's not as medically advanced. It costs a lot more. It's much more complicated.
As the dust settles on the breakup, Aaron has time to reflect and realizes time is on his side.
Hey, what's going on?
I'm nice. How are you? The breakup did kind of make me realize I really might want to think about having the bomb surgery, but that was more of an impulsive thing. But when it comes down to it, that sure would be nice to have and not have that issue in a relationship.
Okay. Yeah. I don't know if you've seen that before, but what's so striking about that is that you would not know if you met these folk without knowing what they'd been through. And so the technology has moved on considerably. And if you're getting exposed to this sort of thing all the time, then of course you're going to start to talk like those university students we saw being interviewed. So you know things are really serious and that there's been a massive cultural shift when a feminist icon like Germaine Greer, who we older folk all remember, gets no platformed at Cardiff University for suggesting that trans women aren't real women. So she's denied her freedom of speech. And of course, she's not the only one. We've had Peter Tatchell, that gay icon who's fallen foul of the trans community in the same way. And then of course, just a couple of weeks ago, we had Jenny Murray, who was the Radio 4 Women's Hour presenter, who is really an icon of the liberal establishment, and got ticked off by the BBC for things that she said about trans women not being real women and so on. And what's fascinating about this whole thing is that we're finding the LGBT lobby and this feminist lobby and the trans lobby, who all seem to be part of the same thing, are now starting to war with each other because they're representing different kinds of ideologies. Where has it all come from? Well, I'm just because a little about the culture here, but if you want to know, Glyn Harrison's book is extremely good on this, A Better Story. And on the CMF website, the Rendell Short lecture that Glyn gave a couple of years ago at our national conference expands this for you. But there is a cultural change based on ideological change, and he identifies three main strands. So first of all, radical feminism, throwing off the male yoke, if you like. Gnosticism, that the real self is what you feel inside or believe. It's not actually what your body tells you. So the whole idea that your self and your body are two different entities has fed in. And then so-called queer theory, the whole idea that gender is just a social construct that is programmed into you by the way that you've been brought up and is completely independent of biology. So these are some of the cultural strands coming together. There's a bit of a right to left moral shift as well. I'm not using that in political terms, but the moving from an era where we used to base things on respect for tradition or timeless values that were passed on, often religious or scriptural values, to a new kind of language. It's all about equality and fairness and care and not causing people harm. And then on top of that, there's the narrative power. So in films, in soaps, in the sorts of interviews we just saw with people on YouTube that young people are watching, it's just in the context of personal testimony and story, subtly changing the way that people think about this. And the whole thing really burst onto the scene internationally a couple of years ago with this picture on the Vanity Fair magazine front cover. Now, this is Caitlyn Jenner, who the older members of us will know as Bruce Jenner, who won a gold medal at the Olympics for the US in decathlon back in the 1970s. And so Bruce is now Caitlyn. He's taken hormones but hasn't yet had top or bottom surgery, and he's all sort of intermarried with the Kardashian family. So when someone so high profile like this as a celebrity comes out, that's when it really bursts onto the scene. That was, Americans will tell you, this was the game changer. It was Bruce Jenner. And then, of course, on this side of the Atlantic, we have similar things in film and high profile celebrities. So The Danish Girl was a film about the first transsexual in Denmark who'd had male to female transitioning and surgery back in the early part of the 20th century and died from the complications of that. And the film was played by Eddie Redmayne in the title role, who everyone knows very well. So celebrities, media, story, high profile, credence to what has been a much more gradual cultural change. And that's why it all seems to have burst upon the scene. And everyone's trying to keep up with it and play ball and not seem to be wanting to challenge it in any way. So Facebook tried to be politically correct and offer people different genders, and they gave suggestions. And when it got up to 71, they decided there wasn't enough memory in the software to be able to enable all the possible genders that people wanted. And so they then changed it so that you now choose the way you want to describe yourself rather than picking from them. And you might say, now, what are these 71 options? Well, here are some of them. And you'll recognize in the top left-hand corner, male and female, of course. But every single one has its symbol: bigender, androgyne, neutral, demi-boy, demi-girl, and so on and so forth. You've got bush and allegender and so on. And more driven by the idea that everyone thinks they are unique, a one of a kind, and that they want to identify in their own special way. Now, the legal changes took place a little bit earlier, and I'm not going to say much about this because Mark's going to go into this in much, much more detail later. But there are two principal pieces of legislation: the Gender Recognition Act, which allowed transgender people to be legally recognized in their new gender, happened in 2004, and then the Equality Act brought legal protection on the basis of gender reassignment. And that's important. It's gender reassignment as opposed to gender identity. So you had to have gone through gender recognition in order to to be caught by this, and it's unlawful to discriminate against transgender people. But there are attempts to take it a lot further. And in Parliament just a year ago, the Women and Equalities Committee of the House of Commons published this report on transgender equality, where they would like to see things going in the future. And these are some of their proposals. 16 and 17-year-olds to be eligible to apply for gender recognition. At the moment, it's only 18 and above. Assessment of child and adolescent service users so that we can streamline gender reassignment in younger people. And they also suggested the government should be moving towards non-gendering of all official records as well, so as not to discriminate against those who identify as a different gender. But Mark will go into that in much more detail. Now, where this impacts in the medical profession, you work in a GP practice near to a university in a large southern English city. During term time, you see on average one transgender patient a day. They are without exception on antidepressants. Now, you might think I've made this up, but this is exactly the situation that was described to me by a CMF member who was a GP in a southeast English city. What do I do? She said. Now, I saw the same GP a couple of months ago, and she told me that it slowed down slightly. She's not seeing as many now, but it was one a day, and they were all on antidepressants. And they all wanted referral to the Tavistock and Portman Clinic in London for gender reassignment. And of course, it hits the BBC. So this is a little boy who wants to be a girl, doesn't want to grow a beard, and is seeking gender reassignment early. And what we're seeing is the explosion and exponential increase in the number of referrals to these clinics. So Tavistock and Portman was the first. You can see for the numbers here that the number of referrals doubled in just a year. We haven't got the 2017 figures out yet, but we expect the trend to continue. The mode age was 16, but 167 children aged 10 or under were referred, and that included 3 children aged 3. This is from The Guardian just a couple of months ago, and if you read this article, you'll see it's not just London, but they go through the figures all over the UK who are doing this, and it's the same pattern we're seeing everywhere, an annual doubling of referrals to them. So what is going on? What on earth is going on? Now, we see the changes taking place within the professions as well. So the DSM-IV, which is the Diagnostic and Screening Manual of Mental Health Disorders, which most medics will know about, if only vaguely, and we know every few years it gets updated. DSM-IV in 2000 had a condition called gender identity disorder, but when we get to the latest edition in 2013, that's disappeared. It's now called gender dysphoria. And it's only a problem if there is distress or dysphoria associated with this feeling of incongruence between what you believe about yourself and what your body tells you. And change was strongly ideologically driven, with the aim being to depathologize the condition altogether. And some of you will remember back to the DSM-II, where homosexuality was actually seen as a paraphilia. And then by the time we got to the DSM-III, it had ceased to be seen as a mental health disorder at all. So it's a similar kind of change, but 30 years later taking place. And this CMF document was written in, you can see the date, 2004. And the author was Andrew Sims, who was past president of the Royal College of Psychiatrists. And we would never get away with this now. We would be subject to all sorts of attacks because using this term is so politically incorrect within the profession. And it was very difficult when we came to rewrite this to get anybody to do it. And we must have asked a dozen CMF members, and no one was willing to put their name to it. And so it actually came down to, well, you'll see the names up there, a chest physician and a retired general surgeon were the ones who eventually, why? Well, because neither of us have a reputation left to defend, and it had to be done. And so we did very widely consult, and we got input on every word of this to get it right from experts right across the field, but no one wanted their name identified or to be known that they had associated with it. And that tells you just how difficult it is now on the front line to talk about these things. Good practice guidelines for the assessment and treatments of adults with dysphoria. Now you see the date here, October 2013. This came out from the Royal College of Psychiatrists. You can't get it in hard copy, but it's there in PDF format on their website, and you can go and download it. So this is now a four-year-old document. It is endorsed by these organizations. You can see once you get down to about Royal College of GPs, nursing, obstetricians and gynecologists, pediatrics, physicians, Royal College of Surgeons. Hands up if you're a member of one of these bodies. Okay, put your hands down. Now put your hands up if you knew of the existence of this document that your colleges have endorsed. Two people. What's it got in it? Well, it's everything about from hormonal treatment, hair treatment, gamete storage, genital surgery, and guidelines and so on. Everything is there in a 60-page document. So this has all come in, but largely without the profession being aware. If you go to the GMC website, you'll find pages and pages and pages of stuff on supporting transgender patients. It's just appeared in the last 3 or 4 years. It wasn't there before at all. And I can remember just a few years ago when good medical practice was being updated, and personal beliefs and medical practice are related, guidance was being updated, and they put in this document that there was no right for doctors conscientiously to object to being involved in gender reassignment. So in the draft document, we saw this at CMF, we went along, we spent a whole morning with them going through their draft guidance line by line. We said, you can't say this. We got various newspapers to run stories about doctors being forced to do gender reassignment surgery and so on and so forth. And they took a step back and they took it all out, and it's not in there. But this has since appeared. And I would expect now that if doctors were complained against, it would be a very difficult role to play if you're not willing to play ball, which might simply be updating a prescription for hormones for someone who's been to the clinic. So you can see the sort of gut treatment pathways, prescribing, respect confidentiality in the law, and so on. Now, this is an important document to get hold of, and published in the New Atlantis Journal. It's a report which looks at all of the literature available in peer-reviewed medical journals, biological, psychological, social sciences, and so on. We haven't got time to go through it in detail, but these are the three main conclusions of it. It's come out of the Mayer and McCulloch and McHugh. It's the Mayo Clinic. I should know that. I've just forgotten, but it's a very high prestige American clinic. So these are the conclusions. The understanding of sexual orientation as an innate, biologically fixed property of human beings, the idea that people are born that way, is not supported by the scientific evidence. Number two, compared to the general population, non-heterosexual subpopulations are at an elevated risk for a variety of adverse health and mental health outcomes. I was just given during lunch an editorial from the BMJ, which was making exactly this point amongst others. And then finally, the hypothesis that gender identity is an innate fixed property of human beings that is independent of biological sex, that a person might be a man trapped in a woman's body or a woman trapped in a man's body, is not supported by scientific evidence. So why has there been the shift? Well, the point is it's largely ideologically and culturally driven rather than evidence-based. Now, we have to be careful of definitions here. So biological sex, male or female, according to chromosomes, external sex characteristics, and so on. gender is much more the psychological and social and cultural aspects of being male and female, the way you think about or the way you behave. And then gender identity is your experience of yourself as a male or female. So as we saw in the video that we saw earlier in the interviews, no, it's what you think you are. That is the difference. So it's what you see when you look at yourself in the mirror. Now, of course, to the medics, this is all very familiar. I expect most of the lawyers are pretty familiar with this in general terms as well. But sex can be thought at the level of chromosomes, level of hormones, at the level of what these have effects on terms of internal and external organs, and then in the way that the brain develops as well, and the way behaviors are manifested. So it all starts, if you like, with the chromosomes. And we've always imagined that there were differences between male and female that weren't just related to sex hormones and genitalia and internal sex organs. And we now know from this peer-reviewed research here that, yes, there are areas in the male and female brain that respond to different things. And explain why it's not just all about social conditioning, that boys in the main want to play with different things than girls do. And if we look at the maps of connectivity in the brain, you can find these anywhere, download them. And the point here is you've got the male on the left, you know that because it's blue, okay? Whereas on the right, female, and there's lots more parasagittal front-to-back connections in males and much more cross connections in females. Now, of course, that doesn't mean that there's not quite a big amount of overlap between the two populations, but we're looking at two normal distribution curves that are different in terms of behavior. And so there are some very capable women PhDs in particle physics, but there are fewer women than men. And it has a difference with where the giftedness is. In the same way, there are some men who can find a pint of milk in the fridge. Now, what we have to do is to distinguish gender dysphoria or gender identity disorder on the one hand from intersex on the other. And the reason this is so important is because there's a great attempt by people who are pushing this ideology to pretend they're the same kind of thing, whereas they're not at all. Now, intersex is something we recognize. We go through medical school, we learn about all the abnormalities that there are in chromosomes in some people, in hormones, and the hormonal sensitivity of various tissues that can result in various recognized conditions where there's ambiguity about whether the person is female or male. And there are well-recognized treatment pathways and protocols for all of these as to how you bring these children up and how you identify them, about which there's not very much argument. So, XX and XY, you've got gonadal intersex, but of course it might be a defect in hormones or hormone action or sensitivity of tissues to hormones. So that's intersex, where there is a measurable difference in hormones, chromosomes or whatever, a recognized medical condition. Of course, in transgender, it's all, and gender dysphoria, there are no abnormalities in any of these things. The difference is the way the person thinks about themselves, and dysphoria is where there's incongruence between the biological sex and their sense of gender identity, and when it causes distress as well. So focusing now on this issue, how common is it? And most researchers will tell you that it's vanishingly rare, and that makes raises the question, well, why does it seem to be increasing? But genuine gender dysphoria is a recognized medical condition that we've known about for decades, and it's fewer than 1 in 10,000 adult males, even rarer in females. And it's associated with a variety of other psychopathologies, mood disorders, anxiety disorders, suicidality. There's no doubt about that in the literature. What causes it? Bottom line is we don't know, but it's one of those things where there's a combination of biological and cultural psychosocial factors. So it's both nurture and nature, if you like. And we get this summary, mechanisms are incompletely understood, but genetic, neurodevelopmental, and psychosocial factors probably all contribute to it. But the point is that most people who suffer from gender dysphoria, it's not something that they choose, something that they just recognize about themselves. And they must be treated with great compassion and respect and given the help that they need within limits, which we'll come to. And I guess the key question with this is, what do you do with someone who has incongruence between their body and their identity? Do we alter the body to conform to the identity, or do we alter the identity, in other words, help the person to be reconciled to their body? And what's happened over the last 10 years in culture generally and in the medical profession is that we used to help people be reconciled to their biological body, but now it's the other way around, where we're changing the body to match what the identity is. Or this is a third option. Do we somehow support the person in their conflicted state in some way, but not cross boundaries? So this is the fundamental question. What is this phenomenon, and what's the best way of thinking about it? Now, you can tell from where I'm coming from that I haven't moved on with the DSM-5, because I think the DSM-4 was much more accurate. And there are a lot of doctors in many different specialties who still are very uncomfortable with the way the profession's moved on this issue, although the majority of people do seem to have moved, as I've said, based on ideological reasons. And certainly the way that Andrew Sims, when he wrote about this for CMF a few years ago, he said the fundamental problem is that he thought that gender identity disorder was a bit like what we'd call an overvalued idea. Not quite a delusion, but a false belief a person had about themselves that after dwelling on and pondering on became a deep conviction. And I find one use, although it's not a completely different, it's a completely different condition, but I think there are similarities. Think about anorexia nervosa, where you have a false belief about someone's body leading to radical attempts to change it through dieting. And of course, when a woman who's very thin tells you that she believes she's fat and that she must diet, we don't offer her dietary advice and liposuction, do we? Because we say, no, the problem here is with her beliefs, not her body. And yet we seem to have changed our views about transgender in the other direction. Now, if you pick up the CMF file, you will find, this is just a summary, that there is an elevated prevalence of comorbid psychopathology, 28 cross-sectional longitudinal studies. There's no doubt in the literature that people with transgender do have a propensity to have more mental health problems, and that includes suicide and suicidal ideation. So roughly 10 times the rate found in the overall population. In Ontario, suicide attempt rate for transgender people was 18 times higher than the general population. Now, of course, there are two narratives around this. One is to say there's a genuine mental health problem here that's associated with other mental health problems. The other approach is to say, well, they only want to kill themselves because of the way they're discriminated against by bigoted, fundamentalist, unenlightened people. And you see these two things. And it's an area where, as I put there, the bottom line, scientific objectivity is difficult, if not impossible, because people come to this issue with their ideological convictions. And so these are the options, and I'm not advocating these options. I'm just saying that when people present with gender dysphoria today, these are the different options that are offered. They can live in accordance with their biological sex and gender role. It might be difficult. That's one choice. They could engage in cross-gender behavior intermittently, so perhaps cross-dressing to reduce the amount of stress they're feeling. That might be permanent, or they might go on for hormones or surgery. But you don't have to embark down that line to be reclassified under the Gender Recognition Act. You don't have to have taken hormones or surgery. You've just lived as the opposite gender for a period of two years. What happens to those who present? Well, interestingly, a lot of them don't complete or go through with it. So there does seem to be a degree of ambiguity. Most gender dysphoria doesn't resolve with psychological treatment or with hormonal treatment or with surgical treatment. And when I was a surgical registrar in Auckland, I did 6 months of training in urology. This was almost 30 years ago now. But I worked with the guy who did all the gender reassignment surgery in Auckland. I didn't help him do that. He did it all in private, but he worked in public. And so whenever his patients came in, I was the registrar that got called. And I can tell you, he was an extremely good surgeon at the results he was getting. And he stopped doing it. And I remember one night talking to him about this and said, "You know, why did you stop doing the surgery?" And he said, "Well, reflecting back over 30 years of operating on these people, I can't think of one of them who I would describe as psychologically balanced." Now, that's an anecdotal report, but I thought that was very interesting. And he wasn't coming from any sort of any Christian background at all. It was a purely pragmatic thing. He said, "You know, to be frank, I just got sick and tired of being rung up at 3 o'clock in the morning by the police telling them they had one of my patients there." Now, I'm not in any way trying to suggest that all transgender people are going to fall foul of the men in blue, but I thought it was an interesting comment that he made. And we have to put this up against the fact that we're now getting in the peer-reviewed medical literature a mini series where people are reporting high levels of satisfaction and low levels of regret. So it's a point that will be debate, and people have different views on it. Now, children, just a few comments on that. Gender incongruence is not uncommon in children, just as transitory feelings of same-sex erotic attraction are not at all uncommon in children. And yet for the majority, it is a phase they go through that they then subsequently grow out of. All these figures are in the CMF file, but you can see less than a third of boys persist, slightly higher percentage of girls, but it's still only up to a half. Some of them, interestingly, go on to develop same or bisex attraction, so they're not completely dependent categories, and 80% referred to the Portman Clinic choose to stay with their birth sex of children, whereas late teenagers, it's the other way around. Most will go on and transition. So this in itself is a very powerful argument not to be affirming and moving people in this direction when they're very young. And unfortunately, this is happening in a lot of schools now. Just some of the practical concerns. Changing the legal identity does not change the biology. Of course, it's important to know the sex of patient for some healthcare. You know, it's important to know, for example, that when you're confronted with a person who seems to be biologically female, that they still have a prostate and therefore may be subject to getting a malignancy in that thing, in that particular organ. Some patients feel uncomfortable with a trans doctor. Puberty suppression, we don't know its long-term outcomes, and for a significant proportion, surgery is not positive, and that was the conclusion of my colleague. And of course, we're now getting people who want to transition back after having had surgery, and it's very difficult, particularly if it's female to male surgery that you've had. And I was hinting earlier on how this, we may think that the LGBTQ whatever number of letters we add are one group and all united, but in actual fact, there's a lot of difference of opinion between them now. And I was reading just last week an article written by a Catholic mother in the US who had complained to a school about how everything was changed because one child had identified themselves as transgender and all the kids were being indoctrinated with a new ideology and toilets were being changed and dress codes and all the rest. And she found two strong allies in going to the head teacher in the school. And one was a radical feminist and the other one was a lesbian. Now, why were this feminist and lesbian upset? Well, the feminist was saying, trans women are not real women. They don't know what it's like to grow up and develop as a woman in an oppressive male society. How can we possibly accept them as real women? So the feminists were against it. And then the lesbians, why would they be against it? Well, they were worried that they might be seduced by someone who wasn't a real woman. And so we had this extraordinary co-belligerence where Catholics or evangelicals, together with feminists and lesbians, are actually all feeling equally uncomfortable about what they see as the, you know, the emperor being naked in this new way, if you like. So there are questions for Christian doctors. Do I see patients? It's a bit like the abortion thing. Do I see them? If I see them, do I refer them? If they come back, do I sign their hormone treatment? You know, what alternatives are there? And at the moment, if you look deeply enough, but you really have to search for it now, and it's almost impossible to find because it's in the footnote of one document, but you can still find on the General Medical Council that current GMC guidance permits a doctor not to provide or refer any patients, including patients proposing to undergo gender reassignment for particular services to which he or she may hold conscientious objection. Now that's there because we went along and complained about it and they put it in there so as not to upset us, and it's still there. But given the way the GMC guidance is changing, I wouldn't think that this would offer much protection now if vexatious complaints are made against doctors. So here we're looking at this whole issue of gender dysphoria, and we're seeing that this is an area par excellence where the change in the culture is creating all sorts of new challenges for us, whether we're parents of school children, whether we're doctors, whether we're family lawyers, or whatever, it's impacting. So it's no laughing matter, if you like. There's some of the references there.